have a lot of ands here.
It's a good name.
It is. Fantastic. Well, thank you, everyone, for being here on the second day. And thank you to the organisers for the opportunity here. And also to Catherine, the editor, indeed all the guest editors, but Catherine particularly for a wonderful decision letter, and the reviewers so have helped fantastically to provide some ideas about how to improve this work. So this work is with a number of people from Augsburg University, and indeed Julia was here yesterday, and I'm not sure I'll see her. Okay, so the study looks at IFRS 3 and the decision usefulness of the purchase price allocation, focusing particularly in on the requirement in that standard to disaggregate the purchase premium to separate intangible assets or identifiable qualifying intangible assets from goodwill. So in terms of the motivation for this study, it's a very, very interesting setting. So IFRS 3, as we know, departs from the standard setter, indeed all the standard setters, fairly strict approach to identifying and recognising intangible assets. So it's pretty uncontroversial that the acquirers are first asked to remeasure the existing balance sheet to fair value. But the interesting requirement is the disaggregation of the purchase premium to recognise the target's qualifying, identifiable and tangible assets, and to do this separately from goodwill. So effectively to break down the goodwill that would otherwise be a residual from the, often a very large residual from the acquisition transaction. So IFRS 3 in paragraph 13 notes that this disaggregation may well lead to the recognition of assets that previously had been expensed by the target company. So quite a different situation. So no other standard allows internally generated intangible assets to be recognised in this way. So again, a very interesting settings. So if we look at if we look at IAS 38, the main intangible accounting international standard, it allows some development cost to be capitalised under a very strict set of rules, which if they were strictly applied, very little development costs would actually be recognised. There's paragraphs, for example, 63, expressly prohibiting the recognition of a number of different items. So in addition to that, there's a valuation requirement under IFRS 3, fair valuation requirement, which is fair enough because, I mean, there's no measure available for previously unrecognised intangible assets, which is a very difficult process to go through, costly and leading usually to quite speculative valuations. So it's important to note amongst all this issues in relation to IFRS 3, the requirements that the standard setters via the conceptual framework are tasked with fostering transparency and accountability for the resources. So I've just put a couple of the provisions here. And in addition to that, the second point there relates to measurement and the fact that there will be the requirement at times to undertake measurement when there aren't observables, and that this is not an impediment to measurement, and that even a high level of measurement uncertainty doesn't necessarily mean that we're not producing useful information. So a very interesting setting. So a clear read analysis, if you like, of IFRS 3 makes it very, very clear that the intent of that standard is new information to be disclosed about previously unrecognised intangibles, and indeed to promote transparency around the acquisition. So we know there's strong investor demand for information around acquisitions, and that demand is to try to understand the motivation for the acquisition and also where the expected future benefits from that acquisition are expected to come. So all round, IFRS 3 is a very interesting setting for studying a more potentially transparent approach to accounting for internally generated intangibles. Okay, so looking at background and hypotheses here for this study, and starting with just a few points in relation to standard, the standard rules for recognizing previously expensed intangibles. So the first issue is that IFRS 3 needs to override the IAS 38 prohibition on recognizing many intangibles. So recognizing anything other than purchased intangibles and qualifying development costs. So I would argue that this is achieved in a fairly ad hoc manner by inserting deeming provisions in IAS 38, as shown there, for the probability of future benefits and sufficient information for reliable measurement being automatically satisfied. So the next hurdle is the item must meet the asset definition. And we all know the asset definition from the conceptual framework, so an economic resource controlled with a right that reflects a potential for generating future benefits. So reading through IFRS 3, IAS 38 and the conceptual framework, there doesn't appear to be a lot of economic underpinning as guidance for implementing the asset definition rules here. So there's a lot of discussion. I personally found extremely vague. So it seemed in reading through the rules that this has led to the identifiability criteria as a second step. So we have to have an identifiability property here where there's either separable or the item we're looking at relates to a contract or some kind of legal right. So taken together, I would suggest that the rules for definition and recognition are rather ad hoc at the moment, the deeming provisions, and they do allow a fairly broad interpretation of what might be a qualifying previously unrecognized identifiable intangible asset. And I won't go into it now, but I do talk in the paper about another way that this could be tackled in a bit more framework sense. So looking just in a very broad sense at the economic literature, it makes a very strong prima facie case for the importance of intangible investment and the potential for information about intangible investment to be useful information. So very broadly indeed and fundamentally, knowledge as the most elementary intangible capital asset, as economists call it, is one of the three primary factors of production. So this is indeed important. In addition to that, we know that, you know, over the many recent years, there's been a lot of discussion, papers, empirical papers in economics, in accounting, in, you know, lots of disciplines, increasingly attributing value to intangibles in production. And the economists actually sheet this home to the tendency for knowledge and technology, ways to make or do things, technology to be embodied in intellectual property and labour where it was previously tended to reside in fixed assets. So this gives us a bit of a hint about the uncertainty of the realisability of intangible assets if they're embodied, you know, primarily in intellectual property and labour, and also the fact that, you know, one of the big impediments to control is the inability to assign property rights over people and some types of inputs, such as R&D. So the other point here I just wanted to raise is that economists distinguish between intangible assets as excludable resources, where there's the right to determine use by the entity, and intangible inputs, where very valuable resources, but not excludable, so able to be copied or accessed fairly easily by rivals. Okay, so moving on to the empirical literature. So there is a huge amount of empirical literature. So I did a study, 100-page study, a few years ago now, which essentially came to the conclusion that intangible investment, generally speaking, is valuation relevant in relation to performance and market value, but it's less so or varyingly so depending on whether property rights can be assigned over the intangible investment, so over items such as goodwill, R&D, customer satisfaction, and so forth. So a further caveat is it relates to design and things like that and how we actually interpret the studies, for example, whether information is used. In terms of goodwill in particular and the business combinations accounting, goodwill, according to the literature, tends to include an overpayment on average. Obviously, there'd be some underpayments, but generally an overpayment. It seems goodwill impairments may well be, on average, untimely. And the evidence suggests that the disclosures required under IFRS 3, it's quite a few, are in fact very useful for predicting future performance in terms of returns and accounting performance. So some good things happening there, others maybe warranting attention. So overall, from this very, very quick overview, broad, high level, it's very clear FIS 3 is looking for greater transparency. The economic empirical literature do make a good case for information about intangibles being decision useful in different contexts, but variably depending on the availability of property rights. So overall, taking all these factors into account and the bit of looseness that I've argued in relation to definition and recognition criteria, we do expect that a diligent, meaning quite a bit of effort is put into implementing IFRS 3 is going to give rise to information about previously unrecognised intangibles that is decision useful. So we have three hypotheses here. So the first one looks at the net identifiable assets that have been separated from goodwill and looks at whether these items are valuation relevant, just as a first pass look, and we'd expect to find they are if the analysis I've done up until this point has any validity to it. The second hypothesis is looking at the idea that the promotion of higher transparency, more transparency through new information can lower information risk, mitigate information advantage of external parties and information asymmetry. So we expect lower information risk and increased transparency is going to flow through to lower information asymmetry and cost of capital. In addition, we think that analysts will be more likely to maintain coverage of diligent firms demonstrating commitment to more transparent financial reporting under IFRS 3. And just to note here for H2, which is stated on this slide here, which is the relationship we expect between our primary measure of the implementation of IFRS 3 and information asymmetry, cost of capital, analyst forecast errors following, and potentially forecast dispersion. So I just want to note that the null hypothesis, so if we don't find what we expect to find for H1 and H2, the possible explanations are, one, there's the low-cost alternative to put the whole purchase premium to goodwill in a less diligent application of IFRS 3, so which likely reflects a standard that is a good standard but very costly to implement. Alternatively, it may be that investors focus on income and don't care as much about the balance sheet, in which case the standard is on the wrong track. Okay, so our last hypothesis looks at the idea that some under pressure management may use the quite significant discretion under IFRS 3 to obfuscate bad acquisition deals. So we expect that using benchmark beating as a proxy for companies that are under pressure, that the hypothesized results in H2 will only apply for those companies that are not suspect for essentially earnings management. Okay, so the tests, as with Julia's work yesterday, the tests are using the German setting, German data. Why are we doing that? The German setting has historically large investment, intangible investment in a number of heavy industry, manufacturing and so forth. We want to be located in one country with our tests so we don't have to worry about institutional differences. And we are wanting to study IFRS 3. So this is the way that we've gone here. Our major primary experimental variable is the proportion of the purchase price allocated to net identifiable qualifying, tangible assets and the qualifying identifiable and tangible assets separated from goodwill. So we do a whole heap of tests to start off with to validate this measure, and I won't get into this, it's in the paper, but essentially a number of different disclosure indexes proxying for the general transparency of the companies in their qualitative disclosure. The first hypothesis we find as expected that the fair value adjustments made in remeasuring the balance sheet, as well as the qualifying previously unrecognized identifiable intangibles, are all valuation relevant. So this is a positive result for a good standard test. Okay, second hypothesis, we focused first just on the acquiring firms here. And we find, again, a positive result for a good standard that the measure, our PPAIA measure, is associated with lower information asymmetry and cost of capital as expected. We then do some tests with more power, some weighted tests, and we also expand the sample to include propensity-matched non-acquiring companies. And we find the proportion of the purchase price allocated to the fair valued identifiable assets, including the previously unrecognized assets separated from goodwill, are associated with proxies for lower information asymmetry and cost of capital, with higher analyst following and lower analyst forecast errors, but not with analyst dispersion. So we find no results at any time with analyst dispersion. So once again, we've got a good standard test there. Finally, our test for the H3, the influence of companies under pressure and using discretion under IFRS 3 to obscure rather than make more transparent. We find rather robustly, in fact, that the main results hold only for those companies that are not suspect for benchmark beating as our proxy for companies under pressure to manage earnings. How am I going for time? Oh, my goodness. Awesome. Thank you. Okay, so we have done a lot of additional tests in this paper with lots of economics-based deal characteristics, characteristics of the acquirer and the target firm, and alternative measures for our main measures. Some analysis has been run to show that the main measure, the proportion of the tangible and intangible, identifiable, previously unrecognized assets are not, in fact, significantly associated with the previous period's cost of capital and information asymmetry, that this is a linked to the IFRS 3 new information. So overall, the results that we've come up with here are showing fairly consistent positive results for IFRS 3 being a good standard in being able to achieve what it clearly intends to achieve, which is new information that previously wasn't recognised, now being recognised, and additional transparency. So the results suggest that indeed it seems that, certainly from this paper, that IFRS 3 is working. So I'll just make the comment that it's working despite that there's some kind of looseness around the definition and recognition criteria. And so clearly we're seeing, you know, a lot of companies and their acquirers, their consulting accountants and auditors are putting the effort in, a diligent effort, a costly effort, particularly when it comes to valuation, to implementing this standard. And we also provide some evidence that it is possible to abuse the discretion in this standard to, you know, to report for other incentives other than transparency. So, but it doesn't imply a bad standard. It's more that not every company out there has the same incentives. I just wanted to make another, just a few other comments here, which may come up later in our panel, may not. That outside the scope of the current paper, I mean, it's already long enough, but speak actually to one of the points raised yesterday, that what happens after the implementation of IFRS 3. So reading the comment letters to the post-implementation review, there's a lot of very clear guidance coming from the companies and different organisations that wrote in with their viewpoints and their actual experiences in implementing IFRS 3. So some of the pain points that are clearly demonstrated in those comments, and also in having, before I came over here, I actually had looked up some, you know, auditors and various different consulting accountants. I had a few discussions with them about, you know, how difficult IFRS 3 is to implement. They said it's difficult, but also one of the auditors, a very big audit firm, said that, in fact, we want our companies to identify, find as many intangibles as possible in this IFRS 3 purchase premium disaggregation, so that we have a smaller goodwill and we have less issues around the nightmare impairment-only approach to goodwill. So that was a very interesting point. Okay, so the pain points here, valuing, so finding the intangibles is not, it takes effort, but it's not a pain point. Valuing is a pain point. But the post-acquisition, there are some pain points. So in going forward, I think we need more research in that area and discussion around ways that these things can be dealt with. Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Anne, for the great presentation. Okay, it's my pleasure to discuss this paper by Anne and co-authors. My name is Yang Zhang and Hong Kong Polytechnic University. Overall, the research question of the paper is, does purchase price allocation under IFRS 3 provide information useful for equity investors? And I don't have to talk too much about the motivation and the contribution. It's a very nice paper. It's well motivated. It's an important paper. And they use a sample of Germany companies, which I'm going to discuss a little bit later. The main finding is that the variable PPAAA is negatively associated with information asymmetry. And the proxies for information asymmetry are pretty reasonable, so I don't talk too much about it. The key variable PPAAA is the proportion of purchase price allocated to fair value identifiable net assets. So essentially, PPAAA is 1 minus the percentage of purchase price allocated to goodwill. That's a key point I'm going to discuss a little bit later. And also the results appear to be concentrated in firms that are subject to less pressure for earnings management. And the conclusion of the authors is that diligent implementation of IFRS 3 is beneficial to investors. Well, I'm the discussant, right? So I'll try to provide some comments and suggestions to help improve the paper. First thing I don't really quite understand is the word diligent or diligence. It appears 39 times in the paper. It's a central piece of the paper. The authors expect a diligent implementation of IFRS 3 to be associated with lower information asymmetry. My question is, what is the definition or what is really a diligent implementation of IFRS 3, right? It could be inputs, preparer's effort, time, money spent, etc. Or it could be output, accuracy, objectivity, levels of disaggregation, etc., right? So more elaboration in the paper can be very helpful for the preparers and the investors, right? So suppose they read the paper and they want to sort of do the purchase price allocation according to the suggestions of the paper. What do they do, right? How do they give a more diligent implementation of IFRS 3, right? After I read the paper, I do not know. Hopefully the authors could do a little bit more on that. And also it's important for the implication, policy implication of the paper. And the measurement of diligent or diligence is also an important thing in the paper, right? The key variable PPAAA is stated in the paper, the measure of purchase price allocation diligence. And it's defined as purchase price allocated fair valued identifiable net assets over total purchase price. So it's 1 minus goodwill percentage. Then my question is, why does a higher PPAAA percentage or lower goodwill percentage indicate higher diligence or higher purchase price information quality? To me, that is not quite obvious. At least I do not quite get what is in the minds of the authors when they say that sentence, when they state the relationship, what are they talking about or what are they thinking about, right? To me, this could be related to the sort of IFRS 3 sort of differential treatment to goodwill and identifiable intangible assets, right? We know that goodwill is impairment only, but identifiable intangible assets is subject to amortization, right? So literature has argued that this sort of differential treatment has provided incentives for managers to sort of apply discretion in the purchase price allocation for the purpose of managing earnings, right? And if they allocate less to goodwill, then they have a high low earnings number, and if they allocate more to goodwill, they have higher earnings number, right? That somehow is, in my mind, could be related to this PPNA and sort of the information quality of purchase price allocation, but I do not really know if the authors have the same idea as I do. But either way, I think the authors would benefit a lot by providing a more sort of a conceptual analysis about this relation. And without doing that, at least from at this point, when I read the paper reads a little bit more descriptive in terms of conceptual. I don't really know. I can understand the statistics, but I do not know what is the takeaway from the paper after reading it. Okay. And another thing is how much of PPNA is driven by the economics of acquisition as opposed to diligent implementation of IFRS 3, right? Because we know that you can have acquisitions involving targets that naturally have more identifiable intangible assets. And because of that, these targets are naturally more easier to understand and the acquisitions are easier to understand. And because of that, you have less information asymmetry in the equity market, right? So the separation between the economics and the sort of implementation of the standards would be something really important and beneficial in terms of policy implications, etc. And the PPNA and the disaggregation, the paper emphasized that the importance of disaggregation as a potential driver of the benefits of IFRS 3, which I totally agree with. But the PPAA in itself is not a disaggregated measure. It's an aggregated measure, right? It's basically one minus goodwill percentage. And obviously, the paper has shown a positive relation between PPNA and the two measures of disaggregation in purchase price, which I like. But then my question is, okay, if the purchase price aggregation measures are more direct measures of disaggregation in purchase price allocation, why don't the authors put more emphasis on these more direct measures of disaggregation in the analysis, but instead sort of focus on the PPNA, right? Why don't you use the more direct measure, right? But alternatively, maybe the authors have more conceptual reasons to really focus on PPNA. In that case, again, I encourage the authors to provide more conceptual discussions about the choice and about the relationship of these different concepts. And one of the main findings is that the negative association between PPNA and information asymmetry is concentrated in firms under less pressure to manage earnings. Again, my question is coming back to this sort of differential treatment between goodwill and identifiable intangible assets, right? This differential accounting treatment, supposedly they're driving managers to engage in accounting discretion or earnings management, right? My question is, how does this evidence result in the paper related to that particular detail or specific design of the accounting standards, right? Maybe the authors could do a little bit more test or at least some sort of conceptual discussion. I think that can make the paper much richer and much more important in terms of contribution and implications. to the setting of German firms, while we have a large literature about the legal institution being very important, and IFRS is special in that you have a lot of jurisdictions. You have, for example, you have Germany, you have France, you have Russia, you have China, India. They're all very different in terms of legal institutions, right? And these legal institutions, we have shown that they have can have complementary effect on each other and also on the implementation of accounting standards, right? So I think in this paper, the authors could try to talk a little bit more about, okay, how the readers could use the evidence from Germany and then draw inference from other sort of different kind of jurisdictions. And also in the future, perhaps studies could sort of do a cross-country study and sort of look at the implementation effect of IFRS 3 in different countries. And I think that would be a very interesting thing to look at. Last slide, the value relevance test. Basically regressing market value on the fair value numbers and the goodwill. So this is the issue that came up yesterday with Julia's paper as well. The coefficients are basically very large. I thought if you're using an awesome model and you're regressing market value on the fair value numbers, the coefficients are supposed to be, I don't know, but they're supposed to be close to one, right? But all these numbers are much, much larger than one. And also the coefficient on goodwill is much larger than the fair value number, fair value sort of asset numbers. I can't really understand this result. Maybe the authors could do try to look into this a little bit more. My suspicion is that in the regression, they use earnings instead of abnormal earnings, as in Olsen's model. And the difference between these two is the sort of expected earnings, which could take into account the growth rate, etc. And if you sort of have the growth in there, and the growth could show up in the other coefficients. That's my suspicion, but I don't have the data, I don't know. But I think that's something to look at. And lastly, the papers show that there is a negative association between PPA&A and future goodwill impairment. And the authors use this as evidence to suggest that PPA&A is correlated with the accounting quality or quality of future accounting practices. I'm not quite sure about that, right? Because when you have higher PPA&A, you have lower goodwill. And if you have lower goodwill, I think you will have lower goodwill impairment, right? So at least part of that relation is potentially mechanical. Okay, so that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. No, thank you very much. I will hand over now to Tim for his discussion.
Well, that's the hardest bit done. So my name's Tim Craig. I'm part of the technical staff here at the ISB, and I have the pleasure of discussing this particular paper. I'm going to start with relevance first and talk a little bit about the relevance to the ISB's work. And as we heard from Anne, the main finding here is the greater the allocation of the purchase price to those qualifying identifiable assets, and that includes the previously unrecognized intangibles. That's associated with higher value relevance and lower information asymmetry, so useful information, and also lower cost of capital for the companies that are providing that information. So as we talked a little bit about yesterday, the ISB has a research pipeline project on intangible assets that it added in the third agenda consultation. And the aim of that project is to comprehensively review the accounting requirements for intangible assets. And obviously, there are a lot of questions that the board are going to have to consider and make decisions on. And one of those is whether to change the recognition criteria for intangible assets and those requirements, and possibly to therefore recognise more internally generated intangible assets. And therefore, the evidence from this study of the benefits of recognising internally generated intangible assets, so directly in the value relevance tests that you did, but also along with the other qualifying identifiable assets, those benefits, you know, that's useful information for the board when they're considering that particular question. And the thing I particularly liked about this study was it showed evidence of benefits to users in terms of the useful information, but also to the companies in providing that information in the lower cost of capital. And so it sort of completed the circle almost, providing sort of evidence of the benefits to both parties of that information transaction, as it were. The main point I wanted to make on this slide is really the sort of top the top line there, and it's not a point that's specific to this study. It's more of a general point that's specific to studies that are predominantly based on statistics and econometrics. And I'd say most standard setters, not all, but most standard setters, and I certainly say that personally from my perspective, I'm not experts in statistics and econometrics. And so we rely heavily on you, the academics and the authors, to explain how the model's been developed and what some of the possible limitations of the model are, and explain the results that you're seeing and what that might mean, but what some of the alternative interpretations of those results can be, because it's harder for us to sort of critique some of that statistical type information. And as I read the paper, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading the paper, I had a number of questions that sort of got triggered in my mind. And in some cases, I was unable to answer some of those questions. So I think some further thought and some further discussion and explanation within the paper would be helpful for us standard setters to understand better the information. I've put some of examples of that on this slide. I'm not going to go through those in detail. I'm happy to take those offline in detail with the team if that's helpful. I mean, maybe one example is within the study, there's a comparison of acquiring companies, so companies that undertake a business combination, with sort of a matched pairing sample of companies with similar characteristics, but they don't undertake a business combination. And some of the results in that section triggered some questions for me. For example, the acquiring companies, the cost of capital post-acquisition increased, and you found that. And that made me think, well, it would be useful to have a discussion of how that result is consistent with the other results that you find in the paper involving cost of capital, where obviously you're looking for a reduction in the cost of capital through your test, and how that's consistent. And I thought that result, you know, as I was thinking about that result, I thought that could be quite natural. You know, if the market sees business combinations as a risky allocation of capital, there may well be an uptick in risk, and there may well be an uptick in the cost of capital. But what that then made me think was, well, that's a sort of a bit of a competing factor against the sort of reduction in cost of capital that you're looking for in the rest of the study. So it might be good to have some discussion about how that effect might be affecting some of those other results that you're seeing in the study as well. I mean, that's just one example of that type of discussion that I think would be helpful. The overall point here is, I think we're very reliant as standard setters on that discussion and explanation in these types of studies to help it be relevant for us, for the understanding, for the ISB's work. And it's to remember that part of your audience when writing these types of studies. So the final slide I have is just some possible areas to expand the research to make the research even more relevant to the ISB's work. And a couple of these, I think, Yong actually touched on. So, in fact, the first one, in fact. So your measure, PPAIA, so the purchase price allocated to the qualifying identifiable assets. I think in the value relevance test that you do actually disaggregate that. And so you look specifically at the purchase price allocated to qualifying identifiable and intangible assets previously expensed. And I think it would be good to actually run that disaggregated measure through the rest of the tests, because that would therefore and see whether the other benefits that you see in this study, how much they are related to those intangible assets. And that, obviously, I'm thinking from the intangible asset project, that would be relevant information for that project. I've put persistence of results here. What I mean by that is when I've talked to users about intangible assets recognising a business combination, they often say that's useful information at acquisition date. It gives us information about what the company acquired, what the future benefits might be expected as a result of the things that have been acquired. But they then go on to say the subsequent accounting for that, the day two effect of that, so amortising those intangibles, and in particular, the fair value uplift on those other identifiable assets, the unwind of those fair value uplifts, sometimes it's not helpful for them in their sort of analysis post-acquisition. And that's to do, I think you touched on it, in fact, in your last slide, the comparison between acquiring companies and organic growth companies as well. So it'd be interesting to see whether you can actually see the persistence of these benefits within your data set, or whether actually that benefit from the information actually fades away quite quickly because of that day two effect. And the time series of your information, the data set 2004-2014, is interesting as well. I think you mentioned it, I think you called it the deeming provisions. There were two decisions that the board made in the business combinations project about the recognition criteria for intangible assets, specifically in a business combination. And that business, the business combination project was done in two phases. And those two deeming provisions, one of them came in phase one in 2004. The second one came in 2008 in phase two. So it'd be interesting to see in your data set, seeing as you have the data for that time period, whether the benefits that the study identifies actually increase post 2008 compared to pre 2008, given that second change. And then the last suggestion, which Yong touched on as well, this is obviously a single country study, and that obviously helps with country-specific effects. But it'd be interesting to sort of extend this work for another country example, for example, just to see how consistent the results are. But as I said, I thoroughly enjoyed reading the paper, and good luck with it in the future. Thank you very much.